Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering Baltic bakery bread, caviar, and baklava. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Verde Gallery, currently showing Vision to Verse, Verse to Vision, a visual and poetic dialogue, paintings by Jessica Damon, and poetry by Maj Regain. Verde Gallery, a fine art gallery, cafe, and newsroom featuring hundreds of unique magazines. At 11 East Taylor, downtown Champaign. On the web at www.verdant-systems.com. Be inspired.
This is WILL Urbana. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northern Illinois, northwestern Indiana, and Lake Michigan effective this Friday afternoon until 5 o'clock. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Vermilion, Ford, DeWitt, and Piatt. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for portions of northern Illinois, northwestern Indiana, and Lake Michigan until 5 o'clock this afternoon. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. The English language has its challenges and its delights. Patricia O'Connor, a former editor at the New York Times Book Review, says, "If English weren't so stretchy and unpredictable, we wouldn't have Lewis Carroll, Dr. Seuss, or the Marx Brothers." On the other hand, you don't want to sound like one of the Marx Brothers when called on to say a few words to your coworkers about an important project. Enter Patricia O'Connor. She's written a guide for those of us, in her words, who relish grammar about as much as a vampire does garlic. The title, Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Patricia O'Connor's Guide to Grammar, Woe Is I, is now available in paperback with a new chapter on email. The publisher, Riverhead Books, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Patricia O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You have a way with words. You enjoy language. Do you recall when and how this love of words and language began for you?
That's a question I ought to be able to answer, but I really don't know. I know that when I was pre-literate, I really looked forward to being able to read, and I sometimes held a book in my lap pretending that I was able to read, because I thought reading must be so wonderful. And of course it is.
Right. I wonder, though, when you were a child, the book is such a delight to read, Woe Is I, if you were fond of word games.
Oh, yeah. Do you know Tom Swifties?
Yes.
That was one of my favorite word games. Yes. That's where you use an adverb,
uh-huh,
an L-Y word, in a literal kind of way, as in, that's the last time I'll put my arm into a lion's mouth, said Tom offhandedly. I know, they're very corny,
yeah,
but they're fun.
I like hot dogs, he said, frankly.
Yes.
Yeah, we used to play that in the car, and it was good for quite a long time.
Yeah, it must have driven your parents crazy.
Yeah, well, my father he put us up to it. And then there were these horrible jokes that he liked to tell, these stories. And the punchline from one of them was, there was a baker who got paid according to how many loaves of bread he managed to slice, mm-hmm, during the day. Mm-hmm. And so he kept looking for a larger and larger knife so he could slice more than one loaf of bread at a time. And so what he was looking for was a four-loaf cleaver. And, you know, I don't know how my mother managed to put up with this. But
well, there are worse crimes. I mean, you know, he could have been drinking or running around with other women. Instead, he was coming up with these corny jokes.
Yeah. I quoted you in the introduction, "If English weren't so stretchy and unpredictable." Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful way to think of English. Now, would it be acceptable to say, "If English wasn't so stretchy and unpredictable"?
No, because the fact is English is stretchy and unpredictable. And when you use an if statement to refer to something that's other than it is, you use the subjunctive. You use were, although I try to avoid using the word subjunctive because I try to stick to plain English at all times. But I just think of it as an iffy way of talking. For example, if I were there in Champaign, Urbana, I could be speaking with you face-to-face, but I'm not in Champaign-Urbana, so I say if I were rather than if I was in Champaign-Urbana.
Hmm. And, you know, that explains it so succinctly.
Well, sometimes you do use was, though, if, in fact, the statement could be true. For example, were you there last Thursday? You say, well, if I was there last Thursday, I don't remember. In other words, you might have been.
Mm.
But if you know for sure that you weren't there last Thursday, you'd say, if I weren't there last Thursday, I certainly would know. So it all depends on your meaning. Not all if clauses take the were instead of was.
Yeah, you have to pause and think about it for a moment.
Yeah.
He is, you are. Why do we do that?
He is, you are?
Yeah. We use the singular.
Oh, I see.
Is.
Why, you is a singular, but we say you are.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an oddity of English. Many other languages have both the singular and plural you. We have only a singular you. So I guess it could have gone either way, but it's just chance that it happened to land on the plural.
Hmm.
Similarly, English is different from some other languages in that we don't have a gender-free or gender-neutral pronoun. We have to say he or she. I mean, we could say it, but it to us signifies a thing rather than a person.
Right.
So I think that's why so many people are tempted to use they, them, and their when they're referring to a singular person whose gender they don't happen to know. Like, if somebody calls, tell them I'm out. Well, that's technically incorrect. You should say, tell him or her I'm out.
Right.
But we say them often because we don't have a gender-neutral pronoun.
Yeah.
So I think a better way is just to restate the statement. If someone calls, I'm out.
Right.
Say I'm out.
So it's an even shorter shortcut than tell them I'm out.
Yes.
But also, you know, there's that dilemma, that he-she dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're trying to be more gender
right.
neutral.
Right.
So we're trying to be diplomatic, perhaps. With
right. I think sometimes you can just avoid that by you can switch to plurals instead. Say, people who do this tend to think that instead of a man who does this has his head screwed on correctly, or a woman who does that has her, you know. I think you can avoid it. Either go neutral with a plural or rephrase the statement entirely.
Hmm.
We can usually get around these little problems.
Yeah. And it's easier, I think, when you're doing it on paper.
Yes.
But in, you know, when
oh,
you're
yes.
speaking, you're kind of stuck.
Oh, sure. In fact, in speaking, I'm always getting corrected by my husband. He'll say, do you realize you just used a plural pronoun to refer back to someone?
That makes me feel...
That's the kind of thing I would do
yeah.
in writing.
Well, that makes me feel more comfortable here this afternoon than with you. I can let down my hair. I can let down my grammar.
Yes, you can. You may.
Yeah. When you have a question about grammar or usage, where do you turn?
Well, sometimes I look things up in my own books. That's only because as I get older, I seem to forget these things. And I say, oh, yes, I remember writing this. Or I use other books. There are a lot of other reference books that that I find useful. I love the OED, of course, the Oxford English Dictionary, which is just an endless source of fascination for etymologies and word origins. There's a usage book that I like, too, that I don't know if your readers may not have heard of it, but it's called A Dictionary of Modern English Usage. It's published by Oxford University Press, written by a man named Brian Garner. It's quite good. I like Ted Bernstein's books on grammar. There are a lot of good resources out there.
Yeah. And what's your favorite dictionary outside of the OED?
Well, currently, I find I'm turning a lot to the new fourth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. The fourth edition came out last year, and it's a big, fat book. Even the paperback is a little bit abridged. You don't get the whole thing when you buy the paperback, but it's still pretty good even in paperback. But one reason I like it is that it has usage notes. For example, you might look up the word irregardless, and you'd find it because it's a dictionary's duty to explain whatever words you might run across that you might wonder about meaning or spelling. But at the same time, it will have a usage note that says this is substandard or this is a controversial usage or this is a misusage, that sort of thing. So those little usage notes come in handy.
Mm. Irregardless, does that word drive you nuts?
Oh, yeah, it does. It really does. Regardless is a perfectly good word. I don't know why people insist on adding that extra syllable, but it's sort of, it reminds me in some ways of another class of words, the extra syllable words like preventative. We really don't need that extra syllable in the middle, or orientate instead of orient. People will say, I feel disorientated today instead of disoriented. or how did you orientate yourself? How did you orient yourself?
Mm.
Sometimes we seem to pick up unwanted syllables like moss on the on the north side of a tree. I think it's because people somehow think that a word isn't impressive enough. It has to be made a little bit longer. So
or maybe for emphasis.
Could be. That could be. But that's not a legitimate use. You don't just add a syllable to something to emphasize it.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with a caller in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. I just have sort of two sort of interesting gripes I've seen sneaking into the English language, and I thought I'd bring them up and then just hang up and listen to what you have to say. Mm-hmm. One is using so in place of such. Mm. We had so fun last night. And that seems to be sort of more and more creeping in, and it just sort of always rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah.
And the other one is something which a lot of waitresses do in Champagne here is they, while you're eating, they come up to you and say, how is it tasting?
How is it tasting? I've never heard that one.
And, I mean, it's like, how does it taste this fine? How is it tasting?
Or how is it?
Right.
The food is tasting something, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, about the so and the such, that's an interesting question because they do serve different purposes. We usually use such to modify an adjective. We'll say that is, it is, or I'm sorry, to modify a noun. We'll say that was such fun. And fun, of course, is a noun. Or he's such a tall person. Again, it's modifying a unit, a modified noun. When we say so, we're usually using that to modify an adjective, as in that is so pink, or he's so rude. But I think maybe one reason that we've mixed up so and such is because the word fun has become a little confused in people's minds, and fun now is used more and more as an adjective instead of a noun. We'll say, that was so fun, instead of it was so much fun.
Mm. Are we using the word fun also as a verb? I was funnin' ya?
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yes, that's true. I think that's kind of charming myself. We were just funning.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a regionalism. That doesn't really bother me so much as the misuse, saying something is so fun. Fun is a noun, and so if something was a lot of fun, you say it is so much fun, not it was so fun.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other, how is it tasting?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that one. I have heard how is it or how is everything, or you know, my name is Crystal. I'll be your wait person for the evening, that kind of thing. But I've never heard how is it tasting.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Two things. I got in late. Flammable, inflammable.
Yeah, that's...
It would drive me nuts when I was in the first grade or second grade somewhere back
right,
there.
Right. Flammable and inflammable mean the same thing.
Surely.
They mean ability to burst into flames, which is odd because most of the time when we add in to the front of a word, that makes it its opposite, as in formal, informal.
That's right.
Not true with flammable. Both flammable and inflammable mean something's going to burst into flames. And if something won't burst into flames, it's non-flammable.
Hmm.
So it's just that's one of those little mysteries about English suffixes. Again, I think it makes English fascinating, because in most other languages, suffixes don't have that flexibility. They don't change. That's why we have such a huge lexicon in English. So that's my only explanation about flammable and inflammable.
Well, I remember when I got a little older in school, I used to think it was some sort of poetic license where the fellow needed a space or an emphasis or something and said,
yeah,
well, then we'll do it. And that'll narrow the line's beautiful now. Uh-huh. I'll go on with it.
Exactly.
Inflammable is
really rather an unnecessary word, since flammable does...
Have you ever seen a truck with inflammable on it?
Yes.
Okay, I have.
Inflammable
liquid. I've seen it both ways. You know, that was even more puzzling when I was young. A second question is, I just wondered if there's any general view about whether the English language is sort of on an economic track, or not an economic track, but... Well, I guess you could call it the economic track, in the sense that things get shortened, things get dropped, front or the end or the middle or whatever of a word. And I always just generally thought that it was just, people have trouble moving their lips sometimes. Maybe that's it.
Well, I think over time it does happen with language that it gets simplified in many ways. For example, extraneous or useless things will tend to fall by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
We don't say thee and thou anymore, or thee and thine. So things that don't get used or that seem irrelevant do tend to fall out of usage. Tenses get simpler. Pronunciations and spellings tend to get simpler. So there's that going on. But at the same time, there's this impulse by people to want to be a little more impressive, or you might say pretentious, and wanting to use bigger words than necessary. And you find this a lot in what comes out of Washington. You'll find people using much, much bigger language than they need to. somebody might be described as the a physical education instructor instead of a gym teacher. I mean, that's a very simple illustration, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
We don't talk about road work anymore. We talk about highway maintenance. People tend to use bigger words. I don't know why. I find small, simple words the most eloquent myself.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
The questions this afternoon. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi there. Quick comment on the regardless, irregardless discussion of a few minutes back. My theory is, one, that there's a pretension factor, as you just mm-hmm. referred to, but I think maybe the bigger issue is that people confuse it with irrespective.
Oh, yes, I think you're right. You're right. There is a confusion there.
So
just as though...
It's one editor's theory.
Right. You know, the
program.
You hear people say whole nother a lot. It's a whole nother issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's they're confusing whole other with another and coming up with whole nother. So I think sometimes that's the explanation for a misusage, that we're thinking of some other expression, and it gets somehow mushed in our minds in with the correct one, and so we come out with these barbarisms.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Gibson City, line 3. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling in regard to the he is, you are.
Mm-hmm.
That stems from the fact that English is a Germanic language.
Yes, it is.
We used to have, as you just mentioned, we used to use thou and ye, which is the, both of those are the second person, the one's singular, the other's plural.
Mm-hmm.
In German, it's du and ihr.
Mm-hmm.
German uses the formal sie is plural, is third person plural.
Mm-hmm.
And in English, we've dropped the second person. We use the third person, but we follow the German convention, which is third person plural.
Yes, that you is plural. Yes, you're right. And I'm glad you brought up that issue about English being a Germanic language, because many people don't realize this. English is very close in structure to German, and it's very unlike Latin, which is why some of the rules that Latinists tried to impose on English in the 19th century, for example, that you shouldn't split an infinitive, that you shouldn't put a preposition at the end of a sentence, all those were attempts to impose Latin structure on a Germanic language. And that's why those rules are so awkward and so silly, frankly, and why grammarians have been trying to debunk them for years. So when you run across a very silly rule of English language, as in that you shouldn't put a preposition at the end of a sentence, chances are it's not really a rule at all. It's a myth of English someone trying to impose a Romance language onto a Germanic language.
Now, I have two other comments. One, the orient and orientate.
Mm-hmm.
I realize that orientate means to turn to the east.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're disorientated, that means you're turned somewhere other than east.
Well, also, orient means to turn toward the east.
Yeah, but it can also be used as in getting your bearings.
Right, and
where
there...
orientate is specific.
Well, there's a sport actually called orienteering,
as
you probably know, which is figuring out where you are, I think, is the simplest
thing. Yeah, and how to get to the next place.
Right.
And I also want to, you're the host here, when you were talking about the word games played in the car, I was glad to hear that, because then I don't feel like my family and I are so peculiar. My dad used to do that with us, and I passed it on to our kids. And thank you for putting up with me.
Oh, not a problem at all. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. And let's talk with another listener, a caller in Champaign, line 1. Hi.
Hi. Well, before I get to my comment, I do have a Tom Swifty for you.
Mm-hmm.
I like to bite my nails, he said quickly.
Oh, I haven't heard that one. I thought I'd heard every Tom Swifty there was.
Well,
good.
I just made it up.
<That's>
Let me second your recommendation of Brian Garner's book. And also, you were talking about the language coming out of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
There, Richard Lanham has a book, I think, now in the fourth edition called Revising Prose. He calls that the official style,
mm-hmm.
where if you write what you mean in, say, a page, it doesn't look long enough or impressive enough, mm-hmm. so you need to add air to it.
Right.
As in saying, this sentence is in need of an active verb rather than this sentence needs an active
mm-hmm.
verb.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And I teach undergraduates, and I find that their written style is full of unnecessary words because mm-hmm. that was the way they were taught in high school.
Yeah.
Which
is too bad.
That drives me mad.
You know, I think that by the time, if they do get to graduate school, they'll probably get their reward there, because it seems to me that in graduate school, people seem to be encouraged all over again to come up with big euphemistic bureaucracies-filled sentences rather than just simple plain English. So
yes.
So it's something to get over.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I do have to tell you that my grandmother in the early 1920s was driven mad by her high school's cheer, which was 1, 2, 3, 4, who are we for, because she believed you shouldn't end a sentence with a preposition.
Mm.
So she lobbied them to change it to 1, 2, 3, for whom are we?
Oh, no.
Oh, my.
She got over it.
Good.
Thanks so much. It's a great program.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That was wonderful.
1, 2, 3, for whom are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Write that one down.
That's doesn't exactly
one.
Roll off
no.
the tongue.
No, and would you want to put that on the float? You know,
yeah.
I don't think so. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Chicago, line 4. Go ahead.
Hi, I want to know, I get these emails with no apostrophes.
Mm.
And I just wondered, I was curious as to why people are eliminating apostrophes in their writing when they send emails.
Good question. You know, as someone whose name is O'Connor, who has an apostrophe in her name, I really am sensitive on this issue, because whenever I do business with someone over the phone and I'm asked to spell my name and I say O apostrophe C-O-N-N-E-R, the person says, what was that second letter? There are people out there who don't know what an apostrophe is anymore. And in fact, on many computer programs, there's no apostrophe for the person to program in. So you might find your mail, I might find my mail addressed to just capital O, lowercase C-O-N-N-E-R, and it's a little frustrating. I know it's not the worst thing that can happen to you, but it's true that in email, people are forgetting not just apostrophes, but all kinds of punctuation.
Well, they have like it's, I-T-S, and
mm-hmm.
or they don't even have it's. It is
mm-hmm.
I-T apostrophe S.
Mm-hmm.
It drives me crazy,
right.
Because I have to go through all the email that I get and correct this.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one thing that I think has helped to hurt the case of correct punctuation is those little emoticons and smileys that people use in their email writing. It's a little face made out of punctuation marks, a little picture. Well, the problem is that I think we're raising a whole generation of kids who think of a semicolon as a wink, or a parenthesis as a smile, or you know, a colon as a nose. So I think that has encouraged kids to think of punctuation as cute decor rather than something that has a real function in language, which is to make written language intelligible. So I hear you talking about that. That's one of my hobby horses, is putting punctuation back into email.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Good show, Celeste.
Thank you. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other listeners, you can join us. You can join us here this afternoon, join the discussion about grammar. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest is Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. Patricia, let's talk about its and its.
Mm-hmm.
There's a complicated way to explain this in a simple one, and you reach for the simple one in Woe
well,
Is I.
Well, simpler is better.
It sure is.
The apostrophe stands for a missing letter. And in this case, its, I-T apostrophe S, is the short form of it is. So if you could substitute it is, you want the form with the apostrophe in it. The simple possessive form doesn't have the apostrophe.
It is not difficult.
Well, another thing to remember is that pronouns in general don't use apostrophes in the possessive. For example, yours, ours, theirs, his, hers, those are all possessive,
mm-hmm.
but they don't use apostrophe. So its is exactly the same way.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we go to a caller waiting on line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. I just wanted to know, occasionally I get to, we've got a really good newspaper library at the U of I, and occasionally I read some of the English papers. And it just seems, you know, if you're, my ear for the correct grammar gets a little funny when I read their papers, and sometimes it seems like they make out-and-out errors.
Mm-hmm. The British papers.
Yeah, and I was just curious mm-hmm. what you had to say about that. Are they working on a different set of rules? Or
yeah, they are, actually. They are. For example, in Britain, most people don't differentiate between that and which. And here in the United States, we consider that an important distinction. So if you happen to be reading an English newspaper and you find that and which used indiscriminately, it would sound a little odd to your ear. Another thing that the British do is they punctuate differently than we do. They use quotation marks in different places. And the accompanying punctuation, say, a comma that goes with a quotation, we would put it inside the quotation marks, they would put it outside. So there are all kinds of differences like that. Another one is, and a lot of people think that British English is somehow purer than American English, but that's not actually the case. There are a lot of examples of American English preserving an old English usage that actually got dropped in Britain, although it was preserved on this side of the Atlantic. And one example is got and gotten. In the olden days, English had two past participles, got and gotten. And they could be used to add slight nuances of difference to a sentence. Well, in the colonies, we kept both of those past participles. And in Britain, they dropped gotten. The only time you'll hear gotten in England is in the expression ill-gotten gains. Mm. They don't really use the past participle gotten. Well, the result is that if we say, they have got a dog, you mean they own it. But if you say they have gotten a dog, you mean they've just acquired a dog. Well, they don't have that nuance of difference in British English anymore.
Well, that's a relief to hear all that. I didn't realize that. I thought I had just slept through the high school grammar. That,
oh, no.
Your
grammar and punctuation is much more likely to be correct than the average Englishman's grammar and punctuation. Don't be misled by they've preserved the difference between shall and will, but that's one of the few examples where they've kept a difference that we've dropped. And frankly, I don't think it's any big loss.
All right, do you, is there some way that people like you can actually argue out with people from Britain saying, you know, you really miss something here, or, you know, I mean...
Well, I've had discussions, I won't say I argued it out, I've had discussions with British people about this whole issue, and some of them, usually it's the ones that have moved to the United States and have lived here for a few years, they agree and understand, but... British people who still live in Britain tend to get a little prickly if you tell them that a lot of the flavor has gone out of British English, but it's still to be found in American English.
Well, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Let's talk with another listener in the Chicago suburb of Homewood, Line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey, Celeste, what's the name of Garrison's noon-hour poetry program?
The Writer's Almanac.
Right, thank you. Well, he's on every day, and at the end of it, he attributes whatever poem he read to the author, and I believe he says, used by permission. And I always heard the phrase as with permission.
Mm-hmm. I can answer that.
Okay.
That's just an idiosyncrasy of the copyright law. When you quote something that's still under copyright... you have to use, you get the permission of the publisher to use it,
right.
But you're supposed to say used by permission. And if you see it written out, say a book is quoting a poem that's still under copyright, they'll say used by permission.
Oh, okay.
It's just an oddity of copyright.
Convention, then.
Means the same thing.
Yeah, all right. Well, that solves my problem. In regard to the previous call, I was just going to make a comment. This may be a little off your subject, but... As far as preserving the English in the language, in the spoken, I'd always been taught that the Appalachian language is much closer to Elizabethan English than anything that exists elsewhere.
Well, I think that may be an urban legend.
Really?
I've heard that over the years, but I've never found anything that would back it up.
Okay.
So I'm skeptical about that. I think that might be a myth.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Okay.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana, Line 2. Hi.
Good afternoon. Would you speak to the issue of the word done, meaning finished, that's creeping into both language and in newspapers a lot? Mm-hmm. If it's proper, what's correct? And
it's proper, but I know what you're asking because a lot of people are under the impression that to say I'm done is not as good as saying I'm finished. In other words, if a kid has an empty plate and would like to leave the table, you might say, "Have you finished?" And he'll say, "I'm done." You might say, "Oh, say I'm
finished." Or he might say, and often what I hear is, "When I'm done finished,
I'm done finished."
Meaning, so is the word "done" correctly used when you say, "When I'm done, I'll call you back"? Or
yeah, it's perfectly all right. It's idiomatic, which means that it may not make sense from a strictly grammatical point of view, but it has a very long history, and there's nothing wrong with it, really.
Okay. Oh, that's fine. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks for
you know,
the call.
Reason I know that is when I wrote my book, What Was I? And that was my first book, and it's now revised. But when I did that book, I was under the impression that done was somehow not as good as finished. And when I researched it, I found out that I was wrong. And I found out that a lot of my preconceptions were wrong. When I really tracked them down into the far reaches of English and the history of our language, I had a lot of misconceptions.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know about done because my mother was such a stickler on that.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't say, I'm done.
I'm done.
I'm finished. May I be excused?
Yeah.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, Line 3. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. That's all very interesting, but I think these people who have been calling in are my generation because they're saying things properly. And speaking of my generation, an elderly man said to me the other day, he happens to be a retired professor from the University of Illinois, he said, "What does DIS mean? D-I-S. I said, "D-I-S, I don't know."
Right.
And
well,
I looked it up in my old college dictionary and I couldn't find
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you wouldn't find it.
No.
It's short for disrespect.
Oh, I thought it was for distinguished.
No, it's short for disrespect, and disrespect is ordinarily a noun. But in recent years, it has come to be used in a slangy way as a verb. Don't disrespect me. And the truth is that disrespect used to be a verb a few hundred years ago,
uh-huh.
and it fell out of use. And now it's somehow been revived by hip-hoppers and rap music and whatnot. And this is the short verse. Don't diss me means don't disrespect me or don't show me any disrespect.
Or disrespect or disapprove
right. Yeah, it's usually spelled D-I-S-S.
The two of us figured it out, but I've studied Old English, and I don't remember ever running across that. Well, thank you. That solves a big problem for two very elderly people. Your explanation.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with a listener in Terre Haute, Indiana, next. Line one. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking me. I want to get back a moment to what was said about punctuation on emails and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the technology is the factor there because people are writing in a hurry, usually in a very uncomfortable fashion. But
mm-hmm.
I think we need to think of this from a historical perspective. I would like to hear your comments regarding when apostrophes were first used. That must have caused a controversy for people back then
mm-hmm.
who wanted to be more pure in the language. I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Well, apostrophes used in the sense in which you're talking about them first came into use with contractions, as in isn't, I-S-N apostrophe T, shan't, S-H-A-N apostrophe T for shall not, those sorts of usages. And although contractions have been around for hundreds of years, they've always had to defend themselves. People have often thought of contractions as less reputable usages. So the very sight of an apostrophe sort of advertised this is a contraction, and therefore it's kind of a colloquialism or a little bit slangy. Well, contractions actually are pretty respectable, as we now know. So I don't think they have that onus anymore. There's no stigma about it. I can't tell you when contractions came into use for possessives, but I have a feeling that they were replacing, say, instead of John's coat, the coat of John. It was probably considered that John's coat was a sort of contraction of the coat of John. Mm. I'm speculating there. So that's not very professional of me, but off the top of my head, that's what I would guess. So I think that the whole issue of punctuation is important because punctuation helps us understand written language better, and written emails need all the help they can get.
Hmm.
You can make an email more readable. Please do so.
Yeah. But, you know, this idea of about history, if you go back and if you look at examples of personal correspondence, let's
mm-hmm.
say, from
mm-hmm.
long ago,
mm-hmm.
the spelling and the punctuation is pretty funky sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and
definitely.
These are people, you might be reading someone's correspondent who was a very bright person.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
Casual use of language has a long history. We didn't just start doing it recently.
yeah. We've used up all the time. It's just flown by. Patricia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks
maybe
for
you'd,
having me.
Maybe you'd come back and be our guest again.
Anytime.
We'd love to have you. Patricia O'Connor has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for her book, Woe Is I, The Grammarphobe's Guide to Better English in Plain English. It's a lot of fun. Just to give you an example of a fun chapter title, Kama Sutra. Or how about Death Sentence? Do cliches deserve to die? And another chapter, The Living Dead, Let Bygone Rules Be Gone. So anyway, our thanks once again this afternoon to Patricia O'Connor, author of Woe Is I. Her book is available in paperback from Riverhead Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was a rough week at the Chicago Board of Trade, especially in that soybean pit where, as a new lead option, August lost 156.5 from just a week ago. We'll get to the specifics of the soybeans after we look at the wheat and corn. September wheat, a high on the day of 337, a low of 331.5, settling 333.25 on change. December, a high of 350, a low of 345, settling 346.5. March, a high of 361, a low of 355, settling at 355.75, down 1.75. May, a high of 365, a low of 360, settling 360.5, unchanged. July wheat, a high of 359.5, a low of 355, settling 356.5, up 1. September corn, a high of 241, a low of 238.75, settling 239, down 3.5. December, a high of 249.25, a low of 247, settling 247.5, invading Monday's low on the week of 249, and that's not good for the technical charts. We'll be talking about that with Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities at 206 on the closing market report. The change on the day, down 2.75. March corn, a high of 257, a low of 255, settling 255.25, down 2.75. May, a high of 262.5, a low of 260.75, settling 261, down 2.25. July, a high of 265.75, a low of 264.5, settling 264.5, down 2.5. September, a high of 265, a low of 262.5, settling 263, down 0.25. September oats, a high of 138.5, a low of 136.25, settling 136.75 on change. December, a high of 145.5, a low of 142.5, settling 142.75, down 1. August soybeans, a high of 738, a low of 705, settling 707.5, down 43.5 on the day. September, a high of 668, a low of 647, settling 651, down 11. November, a high of 655, a low of 638, settling 640.5, down 5. January, a high of 659, a low of 644, settling 644.5, down 5.5. March, a high of 662, a low of 648, settling 650, down 5. May, a high of 660, a low of 645.5, settling 647.5, down 4. August soybean meal taking another massive hit today, a high on the day of 250, a low of 240, settling almost on those lows at 240.80, down 13.50. September, a high of 226, a low of 220.50, settling 221.80, down 570. August soybean oil, a high of 26.60, a low of 26.15, settling 26.35, down 8. September, the only contract on the board today except for the July wheat contract in the green, a high of 25.95, a low of 25.42, settling 25.65, up 12 on the day. The settlement prices are also in on the Merc, where it was a mixed day, Celeste.
Thank you very much, Dave. Yeah, let's take a look at what happened today. As far as the livestock prices go, August feeder cattle, today's high 109.45, the low 107.70, the settlement 108.52.5, that down 10. September 108.30, the high 106.70, the low 107.60, the settlement, that up 10. October 106.15, the high 104.75, the low 105.90, the settlement, that up 55. August live cattle 83.47.5, the high 82.25, the low finishing at 83.07.5, up 30. October live cattle, 85.75 the high, 84.65 the low, 85.40 the settlement, that down 15. August lean hogs, 73.80 the high, 73 even the low, 73.15 the settlement, that down 50. October, 65.35 the high, 64.25 the low, 64.40 the settlement, that down 95. December lean hog, 61.27.5, today's high, the low, 60.70, finishing at 60.87.5, down 42.5. February lean hog, 60.37.5 the high, 60.02.5 the low, 60.37.5 the settlement, that up 32.5. July pork bellies, 113.27.5 today's high, 110.85 the low, 111.65 the settlement, that down 220. The Dow down 3 points at 10,160. The Nasdaq off 20 points at 1893. The S&P 500 two lower at 1104.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northern Illinois, northwestern Indiana, and Lake Michigan, effective this Friday afternoon until 5 o'clock. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Vermilion, Ford, DeWitt, and Piatt. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for portions of northern Illinois, northwestern Indiana, and Lake Michigan until 5 o'clock.
Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Sue Neff from Missoula, Montana writes, "Dear Dr. Science, is there a gene missing in men's ear canals that gives them selective hearing?"
Yeah, you could say that. That particular gene resides in the ear, nose, and throat chromosome. Also suppresses emotive speech. When a man suspects that a woman wants to talk about their relationship, this gene literally takes over the autonomic nervous system, causing rapid, shallow breathing, a drop in blood pressure, and an intense desire to watch sports on TV. Biogenetic engineering hopes to create a new feminist male whose genetic makeup will more closely mirror what women want men to be. So far, the only working prototype is celebrity John Davidson. And based on this, the FDA is considering banning experimentation on living organisms.
Thank you, Dr. Science.
Send your science.